This is Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
Good morning and welcome to it. It's just gone 3 minutes after seven. As usual, I'm not alone. Although sometimes I fear one day I'm going to be alone because you'll be on leave or something along those lines. So I need to change that intro.
Look, you've already left me alone before, okay? So it's quite all right. It's quite all right. You'll be fine that day. But good morning. Good morning to you. Of course, it is Wednesday, midweek blues on this Classic Business Breakfast Show. A jam-packed one, isn't it?
Have we changed it to midweek blues? I thought it's called hump day.
You can decide. You can certainly decide. What's coming up today? Quite a big one, isn't it? We've got Yanni Rousseau, who's the head of the School of Economic and Business Sciences at WITS. National Treasury had their budget vote yesterday, and yes, fine, this may be after the fact, but I think a lot came out of the Ntlantlanene's budget vote there. And I think no matter what, Treasury will always be a big news feature. And hopefully we can get the minister himself and either into studio or on the line sometime, really, to just talk about his major challenges. And I think those are quite heavy for South Africa's economic future. And of course, the ratings agencies will be watching, and they have their, S&P has their assessment of South Africa out on Friday as well. So quite interesting thoughts that we'll hopefully get out of Professor Yanni Rousseau.
And then we're going to be talking to Kevin Brady, who is the CEO of A2X. That's because they have applied for a license to start offering exchange-traded products, competing with the JSE. It's getting closer and closer here.
Certainly, I think I've always been, a proponent for anybody challenging the JSE, particularly as them being the only exchange, in the South African context. I think that it was quite necessary. At the same time, BMW and Toyota contesting just the growth plans with regards to South Africa. Where exactly is each of them going to get the money for the expansion that is required out of the automobile sector? Can they create the jobs that are needed as well? Not sure, but we'll get to speak to BMW Group SA's business communications manager, Alexander Park, about that.
Right. And then we have Charles Savage, who's the CEO of Easy Equities, and Mbulelo Mpofana, who is the co-founder of InvestSure. That's because equity investors can now buy insurance. And this is to protect themselves against some steep share price falls that we've seen as a result of management misdemeanors. Very interesting. And also, I'll be curious to know how this differs from put options.
Yeah, indeed. I think that will be really interesting to find out from them. But that's a look at just what's coming up on the rest of the show. Let's get it started. This is Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
This is Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
This market indicators are brought to you by FNB, bringing you the 48-hour cash accelerator. Visit fnb.co.za for more info. Looking at the Dow Jones yesterday, it dropped nearly 200 points after Donald Trump said that he's not satisfied with the China trade talks. Dow Jones industrial average fell just over 178 points. The S&P 500 declined marginally to just over 2,700 points. NASDAQ composite lost about a fraction to close at 7,378. FTSE 100 closing up 0.2%. And then looking at the Asian markets, they seem to be declining after Trump's comments. Nikkei down 0.1%, Shanghai 0.8%, and the Kospi up 0.3%. These market indicators were brought to you by FNB. Get a great rate and quick access to your investment. T's and C's apply.
This is Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
Michael Traherne joining us in studio, portfolio manager at Vestact, at nearly 9 minutes past eight this morning. The markets themselves yesterday, taking a look at some of the action that has been, up and about, nearly 5% up for Aspen. Yes, of course, we always look at Naspers, but I think that Aspen story is quite interesting itself. China saying finally that they may do away with the baby limits. Just how many children you can have in China. That seems to be an interesting one, and that has helped Aspen prop up just a bit yesterday.
Yeah, so Chinese authorities saying they're thinking about it. Look, this is more It's never really been a constraint over the short term, but just saying that yesterday, I mean, some of the baby formula companies in China were up over 10% yesterday. Sure. So in Aspen's case, remember they've got that baby formula division in China, one of the few that have the license to actually sell in China. And last year they said that they got someone was saying that they're interested in buying that division from them, and it was something that they hadn't thought of before, and then they got investment banks in to try value it for them and give them advice going forward. And there was news out last week that Aspen now have quite a few potential suitors to take a strategic stake in that business. So definitely one to look at for Aspen going forward.
The pharmaceutical space itself then is bound to just overall, even in South Africa, across the board, is really going to have to relook at how they perhaps do things with an influx of growth then in China as well. But does that really mean that growth in South African terms will be good enough for business to look good as well?
Yeah, so Aspen's really gone over the last, I'd say, 5 to 6 years. They've gone from a very South African business to now a very global business. And Stephen Saad at the last set of results said that it's been a very tough 4 years in terms of changing things for the business. They've had to restructure their debt. And now they're very much a South African company that's got a very big international business, and that's great to see. I mean, they're buying brands from your big GSKs and AstraZeneca and the likes. It's brands that these companies almost don't even know they have anymore.
Sure.
Aspen then takes them on, makes it a lot more efficient. You hear Stephen Saad talk about how they had to approach pig farmers to make their production more efficient.
Yeah.
It's amazing what they've done, and that's how they're building shareholder value, is they take these drugs and they make them more streamlined.
Mm. What are you looking out for today?
Yeah, so today it's very much central bank basis this week. From a U.S. perspective, and this obviously means from a global perspective, then is U.S. Fed minutes come out. What is the Fed talking about? Are we still on for an interest rate hike at their next meeting? How were the doves treated? How were the hawks treated? Yep. So that's definitely something to look at. On a local front, CPI data out today, just in time for MPC result or announcement tomorrow.
Yeah.
Where's our inflation at, considering that petrol was been up on an upward trend over the last
month? Your expectations for CPI?
It's probably going to be higher than the 3.8% that we're at the moment.
That was probably the low base, right? That was the low point.
Yeah, I'd say, because over the last month, we've also had the VAT increases starting to come through. So that's you're going to see the extra fuel tariffs were implemented. So that you're going to start coming through. And then just a higher oil price and a weaker rand with petrol now at a record high. So that's all going to come through. I don't think we've seen it all in the baked into the cake yet. And the MPC tomorrow will give you what their forecasts are and what basis is. They have those forecasts. At their last MPC meeting, they were saying inflation probably gets to the top end of their range, but will remain stagnant there. Maybe now they're seeing that breaking the top of the range, which definitely means we don't have an interest rate cut tomorrow.
Yeah. Look, if tomorrow's figure does come out, shall we call it steady? Right at 4.5 or whatever percent it comes out at, you know, less than 5%, shall we say. Does it still give the MPC enough room to perhaps think of a cut in some way? I know that, you know, a lot of people are probably looking at it remaining exactly the same, interest rates, that is. But is there a chance of a cut, you feel?
Yeah, I think at the last meeting, given that the cut that happened wasn't a unanimous vote and things were looking very positive for a cut at the last meeting, you fast forward to tomorrow, things aren't looking as positive. I don't think you get the majority needed to get that cut. It's also worth remembering that in general, an interest rate cut takes about 12 to 18 months to fully be felt by the economy. So you basically have to look at what the MPC's forecast for inflation is 12 months out. And if that's within their band, then they've got room to cut. If that's not within their band, then they can't, because from a credibility perspective, they can't say, oh, we're going to cut rates today, even though we think inflation is going to be out of our target range in 12 months' time.
Yeah. Moving on from that, Friday also then happens, S&P set to announce its assessment of South Africa's credit rating. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think stay steady. I don't think it's time I don't think they're going to be reversing things yet. We still need to see particularly what happens with state-owned enterprises. I mean, it's a very big budgetary drag on our finances. So until Pravin Gordhan's got in there and managed to clean things up, I don't think things change all that much. There's no doubt that we're still under lots of fiscal pressure. And the only way we're going to get out of that is through substantial growth. And growth of 1.5% is not the number we need. We're needing north of 3%. So I think that's where we need to go. We need to get to before we start seeing the junk rating by some of those agencies reversed.
The man responsible for that in Tlantlanene had his budget vote yesterday, Tash, and it's going to be an interesting one. How exactly we move forward from here into getting that growth.
That's correct. It's 15 minutes after 7, but that is, as Arabile alludes to, Finance Minister Nhlanhla announced his budget speech yesterday. But the one thing he did mention is that government was to review its policy on borrowing by creditworthy municipalities, which falls within the theme that we've covered over the past couple of weeks, where we've looked at the state of municipalities. But to have more of a discussion about what happened yesterday is Yanni Rousseau, the head of School of Economic and Business Sciences at WITS. Prof. Rousseau, thank you so much for your time. Let's look at some of the key standout points from Nhlanhlanene's budget speech yesterday. Which were they for you?
Good morning, Nastasia. Good morning, Arabida, and good morning to the listeners. At the outset, I wish to explain that what we saw yesterday was not the budget speech in the sense that we get in February, in October every year at the time of the main budget and the MTBPS, but rather the approval of the budget of the National Treasury itself to run as a state department. Nevertheless, Minister Nene used the opportunity to give a little insight into the current state of South Africa's fiscal position. And it is clear that the position has remained steady since February, which is really reassuring. Mr. Nene has also hinted in the direction of perhaps a little bit of higher economic growth this year than what was planned, what was projected at the time of the main budget speech in February, which is also good for South Africa.
When it comes to issues of SARS, he used a very interesting quote saying that any tax revenue collection agency must, like Caesar's wife, be above suspicion. And what do you make of the developments we've seen when it comes to SARS? I mean, President Ramaphosa is finalizing the appointment of a commission of inquiry into SARS. And I suppose it's also quite reassuring that the minister used the opportunity to talk to us about the outlook that they're seeing for tax revenue collection for now.
Yes, I fully agree with Minister Nene that the tax authority should be fully trusted by all South Africans. It should be above any suspicion of favoritism. It should be above any suspicion of corruption. These things did not happen under the watch of the previous commissioner. It is clear that Mr. Marking, and the current acting commissioner, is a man of the highest integrity, is doing his best to rebuild confidence in SARS as a tax revenue authority, which we also had before the reign of Mr. Mignoni. And this is a very positive development that we have a clear acknowledgement about the importance of SARS in bringing in the revenue that we need to grow South Africa.
Prof. Rousseau, it's quite an interesting feat, however, that Nhlanhlanene has with regards to trying to stabilize debt, if not bringing it down completely, even from the lofty heights that they had predicted, even in February, get growth up to as high as possible and boost an economy that is obviously struggling with high unemployment levels. He did give some insight into how he's trying to manage that entire situation, but is it good enough, even in the time being, to avoid a downgrade, perhaps not necessarily just on Friday, but really for this year?
The government has done a lot of steps under the leadership of Mr. Ramaphosa to control the outfall of and damage done under the Zuma administration. In my view, the government has done enough. In my view, we will avoid further downgrades at this point in time. the rating agencies will probably wait for the medium-term budget policy framework announcement in October to see what is projected over the next 3 years before they make a final call on a possible downgrade of South Africa. So at this point in time, I expect no change to our credit ratings, but you make a very valid point. We need high growth in South Africa to create the necessary jobs to make inroads into unemployment in our country.
Yeah, quite an interesting one there. Professor Yanni Rousseau, head of the School of Economic and Business Sciences at Wits University. Thank you so much for your time this morning. It's 20 past 7. Let's get into your traffic.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Arensa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
We've gotten through into a time when we can talk about perhaps growth plans, something that could aid South Africa's economy somewhat. The country itself is then asking for the likes of Toyota, BMW, even Ford, some automakers themselves, to more than double their production. And if they do that, they could possibly get some tax breaks. Much the same way, as it does happen in the likes of the US, etc. Alexander Parker, who is the business communications manager at BMW Group South Africa, joins us on the line this morning. Alexander, thank you so much for the time. Considering that you may get tax breaks from this, one would hope that there wouldn't be a massive contestation from BMW regarding the plans, but there seems to be one.
Good morning. We're not really in a combative position with the government at all. I think that the story that came out yesterday was slightly dramatic.
Sure.
We have a highly positive relationship with the government and the DTI. Mm-hmm. And the motor industry as a whole has received support from the government in terms of exports from the mid-1990s when the motor industry development plan was instituted. So the discussions that are going on at the moment are around the replacement for the current program called the APDP, which finishes in 2020. So obviously there's a discussion going on about what the shape of the program will be after 2020 and what kind of support the government will give the motor industry. Because of our location so far away from our key markets, we do require some kind of support from the government to make building cars here a viable option.
Are you able to let us in on what that sort of support it is that you're looking for?
It's historically been a production incentive, and the shape of it going forward is what's under discussion. I certainly can't get into specifics on that because it's an ongoing discussion through NAMSA, and I obviously can't speak for them.
Sure.
But from a BMW perspective, the government has had a very good program and has developed an industry that is more than 7% of GDP and employs, if you include all the downstream suppliers and that kind of thing, more than 900,000 people. It's a really critical part of our industry. And we believe that the motor industry provides not just jobs, but also high quality jobs, jobs of dignity.
Yeah. Alexander, as BMW, you've already just, put in 6 billion rand onto the plant in Rosslyn itself. That's just here in Pretoria as well. Plans just from yourselves in expanding that and growing that at all? Is South Africa still a viable market for you, you feel?
It certainly is. I mean, obviously the local market can't, especially as a luxury manufacturer, the local market can't sustain a factory all of its own. Mm-hmm. So we are an export operation. But yes, we invested 6.1 billion rand into Rosslyn. That was announced in 2015, our plant Rosslyn. And we absolutely consider South Africa a viable place to build cars in the current program. In terms of the future, it's really far too soon to tell. We're currently ramping up production of the new BMW X3. Our capacity at plant Rosslyn has been raised 76,000 units a year. That's a growth of almost 10%. So we are growing our production here. It's not there isn't a bad news story here. We are very committed to South Africa and have been building cars here for 45 years.
Yeah. At the same time, you know, the likes of Australia have actually gone on to close a few of the factories down. You know, they've lost their car makers there in particular. And that was just due to a strengthening currency and competition. You know, we had the currency sort of strengthening as well in South Africa. It isn't where it was then as well. And of course, there's vibrant competition. What exactly would make you leave South Africa if, you know, if push comes to shove at the worst scenario? It's not something we want, of course, but, you know, what are the scenarios? What are the issues that, that would really, you know, be a bugbear for BMW?
Well, I mean, that is an absolutely apocalyptic scenario, and it's not on anyone's radar at all, I can assure you. But, yes, I mean, the Australian experience certainly serves to give us a lesson, doesn't it, in terms of what can happen. Australia had a fairly vibrant motor industry, and now it doesn't. And that's been terrible for them. So, I mean, you know, we compete internally in terms of our plants. Munich assigns production on the basis of several reasons, including cost of production, but also matters of quality and that kind of thing, too. And Plant Rosslyn in 2015 won the JD Power Platinum Award, which means that our BMW plant in Rosslyn was building the best made cars in the world. We do have a very, very high quality operation here, and yes, we're far from our markets, but that certainly plays in our favor.
Yeah. You requested to perhaps double the size of your combined workforce, and that's just automakers in general. Are you perhaps weary of doing that because labor is becoming so expensive and you're perhaps moving a lot more to machinery-based production? Or what is the key element or the key issue perhaps in perhaps the labor perspective there?
I think that I would imagine all of the motor manufacturers are experiencing labor as you know, strictly speaking, a cost. But you know, we have really high quality people, and that certainly plays in our favor. When we wound down production of the 3 Series, which we built here for 35 years and over 5 generations, and when we ramped up production for X3, we maintained our employment levels, despite the fact that there is more automation in the plant because it's a more complicated vehicle that we're building. We have maintained our levels of employment, and we have no intention of doing anything else. So really, when it comes to employment, it's about volume. The more we make, the more people we employ. And, you know, it can't happen overnight. But as I said, BMW has been ramping up production at Plant Rosslyn for 45 years. And our now current maximum capacity of 76,000 is the highest it's ever been.
Yeah, certainly no plans to leave, as you've said as well. So quite thankful for that. Alexander Parker, excuse me, is the business communications manager at BMW Group South Africa, joining us on the line there. Namsa predicting that looking for a 1% increase, a production increase of over the period then to around 1% of global output, which would mean as many as 1.5 million vehicles per year. Let's remember that in 2017, just about 600,000 vehicles were produced, the majority of those for export. And they're hoping that it'll at least get to 850 by 2020. So certainly a space to watch. It's 7:30. Let's get into your news headlines.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
Welcome back. Time to look at mergers and acquisitions right now. Mergers and acquisitions in the country are expected to gain further traction after a lackluster 2017. And the expectations are that dealmakers will once again have a busy year in the rest of the continent in the duration of this year. To talk to us about it is Andrew Skipper, who's the head of Africa practice at Hogan Lovells. Andrew, thanks so much for your time this morning. Whether you read the magazine Dealmakers or you on the site reading some of the articles, many would describe 2017 as, you know, fairly, I don't know how to describe it, as lackluster, actually, as you put it. And what I'm keen to understand is what were these the conditions or some of the factors that affected mergers and acquisitions or deal activity last year?
Thanks for that. In my role, I spent a lot of time traveling across Africa, and it's true to say last year was a flat market across the continent. I think that was for a number of reasons, particularly on the economic side, with the oil price having gone down, there wasn't so much money around, but also there is an element of there's a lot of political risk, and I would say that the three elements that I look at very closely when I'm looking at issues around currency issues, corruption issues, and lack of certainty. These are the areas where I think are significant problems in terms of getting M&A across the line across Africa.
Have those conditions eased since then?
I think it's very important to look, firstly, you have to look at Africa as 54 countries as opposed to just one continent. And in doing business in Africa, you have to look at, first of all, you can't do an M&A transaction without understanding the country you're in, working in it, investing in it, and respecting the people you're working with. I think in the last 6 months, I have spoken and listened to four presidents, ranging from Zimbabwe, Cote d'Ivoire, Nigeria, and Ghana, all of whom are saying they are open for business. That means they're looking to get less corruption, more transparency, the oil price has gone up, the currencies are getting easier, and apart from in certain countries, the certainty of political rule with changes in four countries, at least admittedly to the same party, that peaceful change, and makes me much more optimistic across the continent.
Well, then, following this so-called lackluster year that we saw last year for 2017, what were some of the standout M&A deals that happened perhaps across the continent or in South Africa that stood out to you?
Well, I'd like to hand over to my colleague Vivian Chaplin at that point, who is with me and a leading M&A practitioner in South Africa, who'll be able to answer that.
Hi, good morning to you and to the listeners. I mean, 2017 was, as you say, a lackluster year. There were a couple of deals that were in the South African market, at least, which commenced last year, which are still not closed. And the first one is the Chevron transaction in South Africa. Sinopec and or Glencore are both keen to purchase the Chevron assets in South Africa. So that deal is still ongoing, and that commenced last year. There is the Sibanye-Stillwater Lonmin deal, which is hoping to close, I think, during the course of this year. There's also been some talk about the Murray and Roberts looking into acquiring a ring. So, you know, notwithstanding the political uncertainty and political risk, I think, you know, M&A activity was carrying on, and we're hoping to see an increase during 2018.
Right. Last year, whether you looked at the US, there were concerns around NAFTA and what Trump may do or tweet. And then in Europe, it's the concerns whether we're going to have a hard Brexit or a soft Brexit. And then here locally were, political uncertainty, probably a run up until we got to the ANC conference. Do you see any risks for 2018 that could affect M&A activity, perhaps here in South Africa or globally?
I think I can answer that on the global basis, in that the same rules apply. People want certainty, they want stability, and they want to know that there's transparency in the countries in which they're operating. I think significant progress is being made in a number of countries across Africa, but I think people are still cautious about investing. Sentiment is massively important across Africa, and the sentiment I find in different countries ranges very significantly. In Nigeria, the sentiment is generally very optimistic, quite often in the face of evidence to the contrary, whereas in South Africa I find sentiment tends to be more on the negative side. But people are looking, why do people look at Africa? They look at it because there is potential reward there in terms of the investment they make. The demographics are changing significantly, such that around half the world's working population could well be in Africa in 2050. And there are very significant markets which people are keen to look to. But the scale of the businesses in Africa is a very significant problem. So people are looking at the same issues. all the time, but they need to understand very clearly what they're looking at in each country. So I think that the changes in South Africa, I think, have been seen to be very good by the world markets. But I think that there's a cautiousness about the approach to investing heavily into countries and in Africa and elsewhere. Look, this is a global market. There's a ton of money on balance sheets. There's a ton of money in private equity houses. The bankable deals around the continent and around the world are not there at the moment to invest in.
Right. That's Andrew Skipper, who is the head of Africa practice at Hogan Lovells. Time to check in on hot news, Ara.
Yeah, some interesting ones there. Andrew Skipper certainly had a co-host, just like I had a co-host here as well. But the Steinhoff story continues, right? And now members of parliament still would like to question Marcus Schuster and just how that share price continued to fall. And I guess the word fall might even be used in simpler terms, really, in this context. But, it's quite a big deal. And I think the committee itself just wants answers in saying what exactly is going to happen. Of course, Marcus Schuster has said that he doesn't want to actually appear before the members of parliament because he fears that he may not get a fair trial if this was ever to go to court in future. Considering what he says in Parliament. So that's going to be an interesting one. Will he appear or not?
I'm not quite optimistic, but hey, I've been surprised before by Steinhoff, so I might be surprised this time around. But your market watcher, Michael Trahan, you guys were talking about President Donald Trump and CNBC.com, that's the international site, quoting him saying that there's no deal with China on ZTE, and I'm not satisfied with trade talks. And it goes back to what I was talking to Jamil about, who was our international market commentator last year. Well, yesterday. Why am I obsessed with last year? It's so bizarre. Anyway, so he was our market commentator yesterday. And what I was saying to him is that I'm getting the sense that both sides, probably more the Trump side, doesn't seem to know what it is they actually want out of this deal.
I think the knowledge base has certainly been of question, in particular, whether it be Trump's own personal issues or indeed international affairs. At the same time, the Auditor General is also releasing a report on municipal finances. Of course, we've taken a hard look at that this week in particular. It has been a matter that has seen a lot of attention. As we said not so long ago, over 60% of municipalities are at least dysfunctional or close to dysfunctional. So that report comes out at 11 a.m. this morning. And at the same time, just a quick one with regards to the insurance companies. The best paid chief executive of the country's largest insurers is Sanlam Group's Ian Kirk. He earned 23 million rand. But the one that interested me the most was David Monroe, the New Liberty Holding CEO. For 7 months, he got 8.5 million rand. I still maintain that if I could take a job in on an interim basis and get that much money, I would take it in a flash.
Speaking of flash, let's take a look at traffic.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
In studio now is an easy way or another way for equity investors to buy insurance and guess what? To protect themselves from steep share price falls. I think the Steinhoff issue itself is a case in point, of course. And this is caused, as we said, by alleged management fraud. In studio, we're joined by Mbulelo Mpofana, who is the co-founder of Investure. We also have Charles Savage, who is the CEO of Easy Equities. Mbulelo, let's start with you. Just the thought behind this, what brought it about? What exactly happened? Do you have a personal experience with a share that you perhaps were invested in and perhaps fell due to management fraud?
Morning, Arabile, and morning to the listeners. I'm really excited to be here. So the backstory is a little interesting. One of the other co-founders, Shane Curran, was attending a talk by Michael Yordan, the ex-FNB CEO, where he was talking a lot about chatbots and how AI, et cetera, are going to change investing in the way that machines will be able to digest so much more information. So he then had the thought of where's the weak point in this, and an obvious weak point is if the information or the data you're using to get to a decision is wrong, then the decision itself is wrong. But that doesn't only apply to machines, but people as well. So if you're an investor, you do a lot of research and you try and understand that company. But a lot of the time, all that information is produced by the management in that company. Mm. and you're not part of that business on an active basis. And in cases of fraud where they've misled you, that can lead to terrible decisions. I mean, and that's why you see such drastic adjustments when people do find out, because that trust is so important when you invest in a company.
Where exactly do you draw the line then? Where exactly is that line of management fraud? Because in the case of Steinhoff, perhaps in some instances, in the early parts, it was just still considered perhaps that, you know, some were denying the fact that it was management fraud, while others were just saying that indeed it is. At what point then do you know for sure that this is what it is, and then are able to, shall we say, claim because of the sheer downfall?
So a very important part of the product is that you don't have to prove management fraud. So we're looking at what is the accusation? Is the accusation fit the definition of the policy? And is there a market reaction? So the product pays out after you lose at least 10%. So there's a kind of a strike price there.
Yeah.
And so if the allegation fits the definition and the markets believe it, and you can see that by the drop, that's where the product. So we don't want people to have to wait, because in normal insurance, there's a product called Directors and Officers, which also has similar things.
Sure.
And those products pay out after 14 years, 7 years, after legal processes have played out.
Charles, it must have been then very easy for you guys to get involved in this.
Yeah, it is. I mean, we love innovation and we love products that speak to wealth creation over the long term and wealth protection. And this fits in perfectly. I mean, this is a great South African story. It's a world first. And as South Africans, let's hear more of these stories. And as a business, we are a platform for innovation. And so, you know, we built Easy Equities to democratize access to shares and investments. And if we're going to be true to that statement, then we've also got to provide access to products that make that easier.
Yeah.
So how is this different from what was or what is a put option?
Okay. So a few things. I think what it responds to. The price point and then ease. So in terms of what it responds to, it specifically covers management fraud. So things like accounting fraud, misleading acts of management, deception by management, and breaches of regulation and law.
Mm-hmm.
So a put option doesn't really matter what caused the drop. It responds. But because of this, one, it's insurable, so we can create an insurance product. And because of that, insurers have a much different view than, say, somebody who's offering put options. So the price point, because of the narrow definition and the insurance being behind it, is much lower. So the product costs 0.56%, whereas a single stock put option over a similar horizon will cost you easily 10, 15 times that. So it's much cheaper. And then the ease side of it, so you don't have to buy it through some sort of licensed professional. Mm. You can buy it as an individual on Easy Equities. It's really easy to understand. People read the policy wording and they get it. So, yeah, it's much more accessible than something like a put option. And the time horizon as well. So if you buy for the 0.56%, that gives you a year's cover.
All right. How did the pricing policy come together? Because I'm sure if you had to find an underwriter for something like this, they would be like, well, we've never really done anything like this. So how did that process unfold? Charles, do you want to share anyone?
It's not my product. So, I mean, I'll tell you our side of the story.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, for us, we had to be convinced that it was a fair and equitable price for the product, which meant there was a strong dialogue between the product providers and ourselves. But the actual pricing is Mbulelo's area.
Yeah, so we started working on the product in January last year, and there was quite a long process with the underwriters Compass Insurer, as well as the reinsurer Hannover Re, which is a global reinsurer. And we had to go through a process with them, run it through their actuaries. It was presented to the global board of Hannover Re in Germany, where it was approved around June last year, before we started development. And all along the way, it was really important for us to have a very fair and equitable price point that didn't erode investor returns significantly if there's no claim.
Charles, I think anybody would say, however, that, you know, despite anything else, if you have a very well diversified portfolio, that would be the best insurance plan against a drop in the share price. Why would this then change that sort of element with regards to investing?
Yeah, I mean, I think you raise a really good point. Firstly, no one likes to lose money, so it doesn't really matter how much your diversification. You know, if you've got, let's say you've got 5% in 20 stocks, it's still 5% and nobody wants to lose it. So protecting that 5%, if you think it needs protection, is worth doing on the first point. The second one is that we live in a sort of, in a world where we need insurance in sort of everything we do. And fundamentally, the product speaks to trust issues that investors have got with companies. And we're trying to navigate sort of two truths. The first truth is that the greatest asset in creating wealth is share investment. And so we need everyone to participate. We need every South African to have the confidence to go on and buy their first share.
Yeah.
And if it is that they are distrustful of the management of those companies, for whatever reasons it might be, I mean, I'm not sensitive. I'm Purple Group, and unfortunately we're not insured yet, but I'm sure we'll get there in terms of the universe. But as a CEO of Purple Group, I'm not offended by someone wanting to ensure the outcome of my company. I think other CEOs might be. But it's not an indictment on the management team. It's the fact that the individual is incapable of assessing whether or not fraud could be taking place, and wants that eliminated from their risk profile, and therefore wanted insured. And you know, it's a bit like living in a community and saying that, you know, I'm not going to insure my car because I trust everyone that lives around me.
Yeah.
And by insuring my car, I'm not saying that I distrust everyone that lives around me. So I think it's important that people get perspective on it. The third area, which is, there are, especially for young investors, they are typically high conviction investors. So they fall in love with companies. And when they do, really important, there's nothing wrong with a high conviction trade. There's nothing wrong with a stock of 10% or 15%. I mean, Naspers is 20% of our index. So there's nothing wrong with it for a young investor. But when you have a high conviction trade, then the security net of fraud insurance is worth taking. Especially, I mean, look at Steinhoff. I mean, I know of stories of widows and pensioners who had very high conviction trades in Steinhoff, who, had we launched this in November, we would have protected them against those outcomes, which would have been incredible. But Steinhoff won't be the last, and so we need this kind of stuff.
Indeed, but it's only been just over a year that you've been working on this, and already you've gotten this much, you know, sort of exposure on it. It's really growing. How much further do you think you want to take it? You don't want to partner just with Easy Equities and you want to go beyond in that space?
So it is a world first product. So there's some thinking around using South Africa as a test bed, not only having it on Easy Equities, but potentially other trading platforms. And then, yeah, if it works, then taking it around the world. So we're really excited, and we've got really good feedback on social media, etc., from early clients. So it's really exciting.
Mbulelo Mbofana, co-founder of InvestSure, the easiest way to insure and protect yourself against a fall in a share price, that's just to management fraud. As well, we are Charles Savage, CEO of Easy Equities. A really, really great and interesting story on that front.
This is Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
We continue with the show now at 7 minutes to the top of the hour. Kevin Brady, the CEO of A2X, joining us on the line. A real challenge to the JSE still coming up now. Of course, we've had listing issues coming up from the likes of Machto Wieziska from Signia with regards to the JSE. But A2X aiming to offer a secondary listing, particularly for ETPs. Kevin Brady, exactly how do you plan to make this work? How big a demand are you seeing as well for the product you're looking to get into?
Good morning. Thanks for inviting us to join the show. In terms of, we are a young exchange. We focus on competing in what we refer to as a secondary market, which means the company needs to have a listing on a primary exchange. We are just adding an additional venue for people to give them choice, to allow them to buy and sell shares at a different venue should they so wish. So in terms of our license conditions, as a first step, it really just said secondary listings in securities of public companies. And we've gone back to them and said, look, you know, in terms of whether it's an equity or whether it's an ETF, they trade the same way, they clear the same way, they settle the same way. For all intents and purposes, they are the same thing. So we've just gone back and said, can we expand the terms of our license to make sure we include these, you know, ETFs and ETNs?
Kevin, was this always on the cards? Because I remember when you guys launched, everybody was really excited that we finally have another boss to actually look at. Was this always the plan that this is what we're going to do? And then I suppose also the second part of my question is how long till you actually have this launched and you're officially able to offer the service?
Sure. So, yes, it was always the plan. In fact, if anything, we believe the license condition was a slight oversight that it didn't include it. So really it's just been a process of going back and saying, look, this should have been included for all the right, for all, you know, the reasons explained around the equities. So it's just a process. You know, you've got to go back, you've got to motivate it, you've got to make a public comment. So we would hope to be in a position in the next couple of months to be able to offer it. Why specifically ETFs and ETNs? Well, you know, we're, I think, a new concept for South Africa. While internationally having alternative venues or MTFs, as they call them in Europe, as destinations to trade, it's quite new for South Africa, and so it's quite an education process. And what we found is that while we're getting some very good early adoption in terms of companies listing on A2X, because ETF issuers work in financial markets, they grasp the concept quite quickly and they can see the benefits that having an alternative where the costs are substantially lower will play out. So really what kind of made us move this way was we had inquiries from some of the issuers saying, well, this makes sense, you know, we would like to do this. So we're just now making sure, you know, all that I's are dotted and T's are crossed to be able to do it.
You already have a market cap of in excess of 200 billion rand at A2X, but surely as one of four exchanges to have launched in SA in the past sort of 18 or so months, competition is still very, very high. How do you keep innovating or keep yourselves from being sort of a lead in the new market, shall we call it that?
So, look, first of all, I mean, I think the fact that we've had four new licenses issued, I think it's hugely exciting. I think what it does, competition develops innovation, it develops client serviceness, centricity, it develops a competitive mindset, people look for different value propositions. So, you know, this is going to help grow the total market, so not just about, you know, slicing up what we have. So first of all, from that aspect, I think it's really positive, and I think the ones with the strong value propositions are probably going to be the most successful. It's worth saying, though, that of the four new licenses, there are very different business models. So, for instance, our business model focuses on the secondary market. We're an alternative venue, very low costs, the latest technology. It's all about efficiencies and choice. Some of the others are really about developing different value models in terms of restricted shares, OTC space. So, funny enough, while there are a lot of exchanges, we're not really in competition. I would say, though, that obviously the JSE, having done, and can never take it away from it, being a very effective exchange and well-respected internationally. What we're just seeing now is people are coming in and looking at certain parts of their business model and saying, we can do this, we believe, better.
Yeah. Kevin Brady, the CEO of A2X, joining us on the line. Thank you so much for your time this morning. It's been a great one, just understanding what we'd probably call the second biggest boss in the country, the second biggest listing operator in the country as well. So quite some interesting news coming out of them. Tash, it's the end of the show.
Yes, that's right. And Kobe Lagrange will also be standing in for Michael Avery this evening again. He'll be talking thorium mining and share shootout.
Yeah, quite an interesting one with regards to thorium mining, Ethernet. All of those things have become really big buzzwords as well. So we'll see how that goes. We come back again tomorrow. We still do have quite a few things happening. The Chamber of Mines is set to have their AGM as well. I think that's today. So we'll get some news out of them perhaps as well at a later stage in the show. We can certainly hope to get that going through. Today is also quite an interesting one because it's a no tobacco day. So how many of you can really withstand that and continue the no tobacco-ness today, I think is going to be an interesting one. Give yourselves a challenge. Why not?
And your lungs are break.
Exactly.
And looking at SENS, there's results out of Lewis Group, Arrowhead and Rainet Investments, for those of you who want to have a look at that.
Yeah, but it's the end of our show. Thank you so much for tuning in. We'll be back again tomorrow. That's it for Classic Business Breakfast this morning.
Goodbye.